Hi, and welcome to Axelbank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. I'm Evan Axelbank, and today we're going to speak with Dr. Richard Aldous, the author of The Dillon Era, Douglas Dillon and the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson Administrations. He's written and edited 11 books and is professor of British history at Bard College. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Aldous.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan. I'm really looking forward to it.
Before we start our interview, I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping the show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity that promotes children's literacy. The story of the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson years is one of both incredible struggle and of incredible triumph for the United States. Between 1952 and 1968, we saw pointed racism, political divisions grow, a president assassinated, and we saw a war start. But we also saw the end of official segregation, the proof that the world understood that nuclear war was not an option, and we saw an expansion of medical care and of fair housing. Dr. Richard Aldous argues that for 12 of those 16 years, a man named Douglas Dillon had such an impact that it ought to be written about extensively in the history books, but he hasn't been, at least until now. Dr. Aldous, when and how did you realize that Douglas Dillon deserved his story told in his own right?
I think it was really, Evan, when I was working on my previous book, which was a biography of Arthur Schlesinger, who, as well as being a really important historian, was also a special assistant to President Kennedy in that administration. And I was struck when I was reading Schlesinger's letters, his diaries, and also his history of the Kennedy administration, just how important Douglas Dillon was. And I think that in some ways, that is was a particular journey because Schlesinger had been really opposed to Dillon, a Republican, being appointed as Treasury Secretary in the Kennedy administration because obviously it was a Democratic administration. So he went from this position of being vehemently opposed to very quickly recognizing that Dillon was one of the most capable and effective characters in that administration. So I think that, you know, I really feel that Dillon is one of those figures who's been underappreciated and overlooked in the history of this period.
And did his ability to understand that this person may be of some value, even though they were a member of the other party, did that feeling come from just spending time around the person and getting to know them intimately, or did it come from some other means, word of mouth, or maybe getting recommendations from others?
I think it was definitely seeing Dillon in action in the White House and actually realizing how significant he was as an advisor to President Kennedy, that there was a social aspect to that as well, that Dillon was probably the only cabinet member who was actually a personal friend of Kennedy. He and his wife dined regularly in the White House with Kennedy and the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy. So there was that personal element, but there was also just that sense that Dillon was somebody who was immensely loyal to the president, gave very good advice to the president, but also was unafraid to state his position and to, if you like, get his hands dirty in the kind of the regular politics of Washington.
The book that Robert Caro wrote about Lyndon Johnson's vice presidency, the fourth volume, makes it clear that it was LBJ who steered the government from the moment that he was back aboard Air Force One after President Kennedy was killed and they were headed back to Washington, of course, with President Kennedy's casket on board. Your book opens, Richard, with a snippet about the moment that Treasury Secretary Douglas Dillon and other cabinet officials learned of the assassination. And you argue that Douglas Dillon played an instrumental role among those he was with at the time, the way in some ways it reminded me of the way Johnson is described of having, of course, a massive role given he was the new president. But how did Dillon stand out during the Kennedy administration assassination and then right afterwards?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story, and one actually that feeds into many of the conspiracy theories around the Kennedy assassination, because on that day, November the 22nd, 1963, there were in fact three aircraft in the air at the same time. Those three aircraft at different times.
That was amazing. I didn't know that. Incredible. Yeah,
All three of those aircraft at different times had served as so-called Air Force One, which is actually the call sign rather than the name of the actual plane. So the vice president flew to Dallas, Lyndon Johnson. President Kennedy flew to Dallas on Air Force One. But the third one of them was on its way to Japan with five members of the cabinet on that plane. Robert McNamara, a sixth cabinet member, was flying in the opposite direction. So you had literally half of the cabinet was out of the country when this assassination occurred. And it's really interesting because looking at the different reactions that Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, who had precedence in the order of precedence in the cabinet, seemed to suffer some kind of nervous collapse. He was literally put to bed by Douglas Dillon with a sleeping tablet.
So I'm curious, how much do we actually know about that moment there when you wrote in the book, he literally put him to bed?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that comes from the interviews that Douglas Dillon did, private interviews and some public oral history, and also that kind of great book that was published a few years afterwards, William Manchester, which takes literally minute by minute what was going on. And actually, it's Manchester, in fairness, I say that Dillon is underappreciated, but it's Manchester, in fairness, who makes that point that Dillon is the one who steps up on the plane. He starts organizing people. He's communicating with Washington. And as Manchester says, this is really the first effective thinking about what a Johnson administration will look like in the immediate minutes and hours after the death. Remembering, of course, as I said earlier, Dillon was a personal friend of Kennedy's. So this wasn't just a political thing for him. It was also something deeply personal.
And he literally said, we got to turn this plane around.
He did, because there was a lot of prevaricating about what should happen. That should they keep flying? Should they turn it round? What exactly should they do? And Dillon, in that moment of pure command, just said, "We have to turn the plane around."
Prevaricating—that's a great word. We often notice those in history and in current events who make a big stink about things, and sometimes we even give people too much credit who make big stinks about things. You argue Douglas Dillon had an important skill, especially in government, which is the ability to work behind the scenes and never make the show about him. I'm curious, what was in his childhood that helped him develop such a skill?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things, and you're absolutely right that I use the example at the beginning of the book how Dillon had been in command on the plane. But if you look at the film footage when they arrive back in Washington, it's almost as if he just fades into the background. In fact, another cabinet minister literally pushes him towards the front near the microphone to stand next to Rusk because he'd been standing back. But in terms of his background, he was the son of Clarence Dillon, who was the head of the legendary Dillon Reed investment firm. Clarence Dillon was one of the richest Americans, one of the 50 richest Americans. So he came from this very privileged background. But there was also, with Clarence Dillon, there was always this sense that he was a very overbearing father, a very demanding father, very loving father, but also a very demanding one. And I think that, you know, as he was growing up, Douglas Dillon had to learn that quality of negotiating around Clarence, of being able to be able to tread that fine line between being his own man, but also meeting the very high standards that his father set for him.
By the time he was in government, did he have to consciously avoid being the center of attention, or was it second nature to him?
I think it had become second nature by that stage. And also, you have to remember, again, coming from this background, I mean, this is something which is as old as the ages, that someone who comes from that type of wealth has a kind of a patrician quality, but also a kind of a sense of public duty, of not doing things because they're on the make and on the take, but just simply because they believe it's the right thing to do. So there's never really that sense with Dylan. Although he is ambitious and wants to achieve things, it's not as if he's always got his eye on the main chance, always thinking, can I run for the Senate? Will I ever be able to run for president? Any of these kind of things. That it's all about public service and duty for him. It's like he's almost like a Gilbert and Sullivan character in that sense.
Dylan inherited, and you mentioned this family business. Clarence Dylan makes a fabulous amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars, which today is an insane amount of money. But back then, in the 20s, 30s and 40s, it was a really insane amount of money.
Yeah. I mean, he would be a billionaire, a multi-billionaire by today's standards.
Literally billionaire. Douglas Dylan inherits this family business for a time. So I guess explain his early part of his career before he's fully in politics. And I'm curious, did he ever acknowledge that he was not a self-made man? And was he self-conscious about that?
I think that he was always very aware that he came from great privilege. I think that was one of the reasons why he always felt that he had to give back. I mean, in some ways, he's you see that also because he's part of the so-called greatest generation, that he serves in the Second World War, puts himself in the way of danger, and so on, because it's the right thing to do. And that's something that really comes through in his entire career. I think that in terms of self-consciousness, I mean, it's interesting that the Philip Zelikow, the editor of the Cuban Missile tapes, the XCOM tapes, has a very astute comment where he says, when you listen back, Dylan has that kind of quality, like Kennedy himself, but also reminiscent of FDR, of the kind of somewhat aristocratic, very confident sense that, as Zelikow says, when Dylan says, it seems to me, the implication of that is that it would seem to really any right-thinking person. So he has that side to him, but he also has a kind of, if not exactly nervousness, a kind of an understated quality. When people go to see him, journalists to interview him, they notice that he does things like play with his glasses all the time. And so there definitely is that nervous quality to him. And that goes back to the 1930s, when he really did find it quite a strain working with his father as the heir apparent at Dylan Reed. And I think that's one of the reasons why he got out, so that he could establish his own field of expertise and interest.
How did he get involved in politics? You know, I was reading a biography of somebody, and I have to be careful here because I don't want to embarrass that person or make it seem like I'm criticizing them in particular. But I was reading a short blurb about somebody who's been appointed to a board here in Florida. And the person who'd been appointed, you know, certainly has a bit of a resume themselves, but, you know, one of their parents is a prominent member of the legislature. And it's like, well, you know, that's a major leg up when you're trying to get involved in politics, right? It's easy to get to, you know, get noticed, and your parent can always, which any parent would do, is, you know, slip your name to somebody and say, hey, this person would be great for this board. So was he recognized by politicians just because he had deep pockets and could help fund them? Or was there more to this story?
Well, there was eventually more to the story, but it's absolutely unambiguous that the reason he gets into politics is because of his father. I mean, quite literally deep pockets. That works on two ways. That in 1948, he'd been part of a speech writing team for the Dewey presidential campaign. writing foreign policy speeches. It was quite the quartet that they had there. It was John Foster Dulles, future Secretary of State, Christian Herter, future Secretary of State, Douglas Dillon, future Treasury Secretary, and McGeorge Bundy, future National Security Advisor. So, you know, that is, as I say, quite a formidable team. But in 1952, when Eisenhower wins the presidency, one of his most important funders had been Clarence Dillon. Clarence Dillon was also a close personal friend with John Foster Dulles, who will be Secretary of State under Eisenhower. That was how Dillon had got to work with Foster Dulles in the first place. So it's completely clear that Douglas gets his leg up, I think was the phrase that you used, that simply because of his father. And it's a very well-established pattern in American politics that very often ambassadorships go to prominent donors to presidential campaigns. So his first political appointment is as ambassador to Paris, which he takes up the following year in 1953.
How does he do at the job itself? How does he start to stand out? What made people realize that he had talent beyond the ability to write checks?
I think there are three things in particular. One is that serendipity that we talked about before, that because he's close to John Foster Dulles, because John Foster Dulles likes and admires him, it means that he's always got a direct line to the Secretary of State himself. And that is really important. The second thing is that because he comes from this kind of background, he's not dependent on his government salary, for example, it means that he's actually able to speak his mind, so that you even very early on, in 1953, following the execution of the Rosenbergs for espionage, this causes huge controversy in France. And Dillon, in the following summer, is able to write in a widely circulated memo to say why there has been a failure of American leadership on this. And he quite literally says that the president has to be more active in foreign policy. So there's that aspect, the ability to speak his mind without fear or a fear of being fired, because if he is fired, he just goes back to Wall Street.
Yeah. What do I care?
And then thirdly, he is actually very well regarded in Paris itself, that the family owns a very famous vineyard in France, one of the most famous Claret or Bordeaux wines. So there's a kind of a sense already of connection there. And he shows himself to be very good at representing the French view on big issues like Algeria, Vietnam, and Suez, back to the American government.
Does he start to have actual interactions with Dwight Eisenhower? Does he get to the point where he can literally meet with the president? Or is Eisenhower hearing about this guy's ability through other people in his, for the lack of a better term, chain of command?
Yeah, it definitely comes through John Foster Dulles. I mean, Eisenhower clearly knows who he is. There are a number of occasions when Dillon has meetings back in the White House with Eisenhower. And on one particular issue to do with an oil embargo, Dillon really does go out on a limb to try to change government policy and actually does so quite successfully. But it's really not until he comes back to Washington, becomes number three in the State Department to John Foster Dulles, and then number two in the State Department, that he starts having these direct interactions with Eisenhower.
I'm really curious, what were your sources for this? Because someone as big as Eisenhower, obviously, or Kennedy or Johnson, they've got their own libraries, their own stash of papers. So where are the Dillon documents? What did you have to pour through? Was there one place, or did you have to go from library to library to library and do a, I'm being facetious here, but do a control F for Dillon?
Yeah, I mean, there's exactly as you say, this was about using the resources of those presidential libraries, the Eisenhower, the Johnson, and the Kennedy administration. Kennedy Library. The Kennedy Library is particularly useful because it's got a lot of Dylan's own personal papers related to that administration. There was a challenge, of course, during the writing of this book that a lot of it was done during the pandemic. When a lot of the libraries closed down. But I have to say, I have huge admiration for these presidential libraries and the way that they really did go the extra mile to try to help researchers as best they can through the kind of copying of documents and so on. So half of the research had been done, but there was still more to do. But then the real great benefit that I had was that I was given access to the papers of the Dylan family, which included a lot of interviews that were done for a prospective earlier biography and possible autobiography that Dylan thought about writing, and material which hasn't really been used, plus some of the private letters and correspondence and so on. So really, it was bringing together these public and private sources, along with one of the great innovations, particularly of the Kennedy administration, going back to our friend Arthur Schlesinger, who was one of the people who suggested it, was these fabulous oral history programs that almost anybody who was involved with the Kennedy administration was interviewed in the years after the assassination.
I'm curious, is anybody still alive who you were able to interview?
There were a few people that I was able to talk to, in particular, Douglas Dylan's two daughters, who were very useful in that regard. But most of the, by this stage, most of the material that I was looking at was either in the public or the private archives.
So I'm curious also about you, and we'll get back to Dylan in a second, but how does being British impact your view of America and American history? Does it give you a certain type of distance that you're able to study it without being emotionally invested? Or does it mean you have to learn on the fly about our culture and our country?
Yeah, I mean, so I've lived in the United States now for just over 13 years. So I feel as if I've been here quite a long time to imbibe the culture, to use the word that you use there. But yeah, you're absolutely right that it brings advantages and disadvantages, just as it does with any British history or Anglo-American relations that I write. That there's an advantage, I think, to having a certain detachment, that I think the work that I do on Britain is better for being outside of the country and gives me a certain detachment. But equally, being British in the United States and writing on American history gives me that same sense of detachment. The disadvantages, of course, are that you don't have those, if you like, the completely natural elements that come to somebody who's grown up in a culture. So you have to kind of be aware of those and try to make sure that some things that seem unusual to you as an outsider may actually just turn out to be pretty run of the mill for somebody who's grown up in the United States.
What did Dylan think of Britain? How much interaction did he have with your country?
Yeah, so he spent quite a lot of time in the UK. He has a lot of interaction both socially and politically with various British figures. But I think that it's fair to say that his most important European connection really was with France, partly because of the vineyard, the growing and spending a lot of time in Paris. He was actually born in Geneva, in Switzerland. Switzerland. So, you know, I think it's really what's sometimes referred to as continental Europe. And you see that a little bit politically in the early 1960s, because when the battles are going on about the in the early years of the what now we would call the European Union, he's very clearly on the side of the European Union, and he's suspicious of British motivations in those whole debates.
So set this up for me. How does the Eisenhower administration end, and what starts to go off in Kennedy's, you know, kind of alarm bells, where he says this might be a good guy to keep around for a presidency that would turn out to be very focused on foreign policy?
Yeah, so I think that by the time we get to the end of the Eisenhower administration, Dillon is seen as a highly capable, highly effective operator within the administration. There had been one major hiccup in 1960, May 1960, the U-2 aircraft get shot down over the Soviet Union. This turns into a huge international incident, wrecks the Paris summit. Dillon had not emerged particularly well out of that crisis, and so there was a question of whether it would tarnish his reputation, but it seems not to have done. And in particular, the work that he'd done on the formation of the OECD really was kind of highlighted towards the end of 1960. So, you know, he's seen as very good, very effective, and crucially, he is seen almost as a shoo-in as Secretary of State in a Nixon administration if Richard Nixon had won the 1960 election. So why does he emerge as Treasury Secretary? I think there are a number of reasons. One of them is personal, that friends of his and very influential characters like Philip Graham, for example, the publisher of the Washington Post, is kind of pushing his name as somebody who would provide stability. And I think that that's ultimately the reason that Kennedy goes for him. He knows that a Democratic administration coming in needs to reassure Wall Street, needs to reassure the financial markets. And so Dillon is seen as somebody who provides that sense of stability, connections to the banks, and all of that.
What does it say about the style of governing that we were going through in the 50s and 60s that people were willing to look, you know, today when they nominate somebody from the other party, it's like the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, or not that that's not important, but it's generally considered to be a less senior member of the cabinet, if that term is appropriate. What does it say about that style of governing in the 50s and 60s that a Democratic president is willing to put a prominent Republican in a main position in his cabinet?
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying that it's not even the Secretary of Veteran Affairs now. There's no Republican in the Biden cabinet.
Yeah, probably
cabinet.
Not anymore.
And I'm almost certain there was no Democrat in the Trump administration. Right. Mike Flynn, the short-lived national security advisor, was a Democrat. But, you know, I think that was pretty much it. So you're right. This is a tradition that has completely disappeared from American politics today. Dillon is there as a Republican. Robert McNamara is there as defense secretary as a Republican. And George Bundy is there as a Republican as national security advisor. I do have a theory about that in terms of Kennedy, that it's interesting that he puts conservatives into positions where he wants things done. So Treasury, Defense, National Security, and puts the prominent liberals into positions, particularly when it's about rhetoric. So people like Arthur Schlesinger or Theodore Sorensen, and he uses John Kenneth Galbraith, although he's off as ambassador to India. But the liberals tend to be about rhetoric, or Walter Heller, for example, who goes to the chairman of the economic advisors. But it is a different culture. However, we do need to be careful not to romanticize it. Eisenhower, Nixon were furious about the fact that Dylan took this post. They actively tried to persuade him not to. Ultimately, he used the card which he knew would work with Eisenhower. He said, I feel that I have to do this because it's in the American interest. I need to put national interest above party interest. So grumbling, Eisenhower agreed and said, well, I suppose you have to do it then.
And that's why we love our historians. Just reel yourself back in. It wasn't all candies and rainbows. There was a tax cut during the Kennedy administration. Imagine, right, a Democratic president pushing hard for a tax cut like this. Pretty broad tax cut. What impact did he have on that tax cut? And just give us a little primer on how it was targeted and whether it worked or not.
Yeah, I mean, not only was there a tax cut, it was at that time the biggest tax cut in American history. For example, he brings the marginal rate down from 91% to 70%. I mean, that's an indication. It's hugely successful. It's quite controversial, and it causes quite a lot of angst within the administration about how it should actually be done. So Dylan initially was pushing for a tax cut and tax reform together. Walter Heller and Samuelson, who was an advisor from the outside, were opposed to it. Then they changed their mind and try to push ahead before Dylan says that they're ready. So there are lots of arguments going on about timing and the longevity of these tax cuts. In terms of economic performance, it's absolutely staggering that when Dylan comes in 1961, the prediction is for a deep recession. By the time he leaves in 1965, it's been the longest kind of uptick of growth in peacetime history, in America's peacetime history. And all the kind of the major indicators are up. Industrial production is up, wages are up, personal income, capital spending, employment is at the highest rate, unemployment is at the lowest rate. So this really is a kind of spectacular economic performance during this period. It is worth kind of pointing out that it's also done without overheating the economy. Dylan leaves in 1965. There is then massive spending on the Great Society and the Vietnam War. And that's when inflation suddenly takes over.
Did Dylan's presence give the tax cut credibility?
I think it definitely did give it credibility for two reasons, actually. That one is that he's very good at kind of working through the kind of the long, tedious committee stages in the House and Senate, that he has this kind of commanding presence. But then it also projects outwards as well to Wall Street, to the banks, to consumer sentiment and so on.
LBJ and Eisenhower probably couldn't be more different in many, many ways. What made LBJ see things that were similar to what Eisenhower saw? And, you know, you have a great quote, boy, I sure wish he would stick around, about Dylan.
Yeah. That was his view by the end. But frankly, at the beginning, he didn't trust Dylan at all. In fact, it's one of, you mentioned Robert Caro there. It's one of the places where I would disagree a little bit with the emphasis that Robert Caro gives. I mean, obviously, those books are wonderful and we're all great admirers of them. But Caro's argument is that LBJ pushes through the tax cut and that it wasn't going to happen without LBJ there, that it would have failed if Kennedy hadn't been assassinated. That's actually, I think the documents show that that's wrong, because Dylan had a clear plan and a strategy. He understood that he had to bring government spending down. He had an agreement from Kennedy that he would do that. So, and he predicted that it would pass in the spring of 1964, which is exactly when it does pass. But Johnson believes that Dylan is too rarefied. He's too stuck up. That he's kind of somebody who would be looking down his nose at LBJ. And so there's kind of tension kind of early on between the two. But gradually, Johnson comes to recognize, first of all, that Dylan is incredibly loyal to him, that he doesn't try to undermine him. And he recognizes he's just very good at his job. So by 1964, when LBJ wins the election, Dylan says, you know, okay, you have your own mandate now, Mr. President, and he submits his resignation. Johnson does everything he can to plead with him not to do that, including when Dylan is down in Florida, where you are now. He sends a plane down to Florida to fly Dylan up to the LBJ ranch, and he kind of applies the treatment to him, pleading with him to stay. Eventually, Dylan says, "Well, look, I'll stay until the middle of next year, just to kind of for your transition, but then you have to find a new secretary."
Are there any prominent mistakes we should be aware of?
That Dylan made. Yeah, I think that, I mean, there are a number of things through his career that he gets wrong. He's embarrassed over the Suez Crisis in 1956, where the French government plays him, that they send a junior minister who's a friend of Dylan's to say, we're not going to do anything in Egypt. This isn't really going to happen. If we do, it won't happen till after the election. And then about a week later, in the French and the British and the Israelis go to Suez. So that's an embarrassment for him. Then the Paris summit and the collapse of that over the U2 crisis, that's another embarrassment for him. More strategically, the thing that he grapples with throughout the administration, but is really unable to really do anything other than, at very best, neutralize, is the balance of payment deficit. So the balance of payment deficit, as you know, is basically the money that comes into the country versus the money that goes out of the country. That was in deficit. JFK said there were two things that kept him up at night. One was the threat of nuclear war. The second was the balance of payments deficit. So this is something that's central. Dylan tries all kinds of reforms. He has all kinds of schemes. He has all kinds of things that he does with Robert McNamara to force overseas allies to buy American equipment and so on. And so there's some movement in that, but really that is a kind of a problem at the beginning of his term, and it's still a problem by the end.
What's the single biggest piece of positive influence that you believe he had?
I think that clearly the tax cut, the 1964 Revenue Act, is the headline act for Dylan. Theodore White, in his book about this, says that, you know, that if it hadn't have been for the assassination and then the subsequent passing of the civil rights legislation, this would have been the most important piece of legislation of that Kennedy's first term. Mm. If Kennedy had lived and had fought the 1964 election, that would have been the kind of the main thing that he would have been going into the election promoting. Thinking of Bill Clinton and James Carville, you know, it's the economy, stupid.
You say Dylan brought a type of conservative sensibility that seems lost in the 2020s. What do you mean by that?
I think that it's a kind of conservatism that is also centrist. That Dylan was never really right wing in the sense that perhaps we might think of conservatism now. He's more of, at the time they called them modern Republicans, people like Dylan, Nelson Rockefeller, Christian Herter, these kind of characters, and it's a centrist kind of political philosophy. Yes, it does kind of build across the aisle. It does look to try and find consensus, but there's also a sensibility that comes from his background that this is almost the last moment where patricians can go into politics in an uncomplicated kind of way, that, you know, after Dylan, we move into the civil unrest of the 1960s. Racial issues become much more prominent and sharply defined, class issues and so on. When Dylan was there, it was just accepted that somebody of his background should want to come in and through a sense of public duty to do his bit, as Richard Rorty says, to do his bit, to lend a hand.
Someone who picks up your book today, who's in government, what is the lesson from Douglas Dylan's life for them?
I think that the lesson of Douglas Dylan's life actually is that you can blend expertise with a sense of public duty. And that actually, if you really want to implement radical reform, which after all, say that the Revenue Act was, you have to build alliances. You have to be able to work with people within your own party and outside of your party in order to mobilize enough of a force to pass this kind of legislation.
Who is a modern day Douglas Dylan? Does that person exist?
That's a very interesting question, and not actually one that I have particularly thought about. I suppose the obvious answer would be somebody who is in the news at the moment. Perhaps it would be someone like Mitt Romney, that Mitt Romney comes from a financial background in the way that Douglas Dylan did. He's served in different roles as a governor, as a senator, as a presidential candidate. But I think that the thing that really stands out about Mitt Romney is that, without getting into the politics of the rights and wrongs of these things, that he showed political courage. He showed political courage on things like impeachment and so on. And so I think that kind of sense of public duty, somebody who clearly has a great wealth, who comes, as Romney did, from a family, as you were saying right at the very beginning, that is able to smooth his way into politics. That seems to me to perhaps be a modern Douglas Dylan.
What was the end of his life like? How did he spend his final years?
So Dylan leaves public office in 1965, and then
he died in 2003. I mean, that's 40 years.
He does, and he really does a couple of things. That he does become one of the so-called wise men of politics. So he helps the Johnson administration in those difficult conversations about Vietnam. He serves on a presidential commission for Ford about the CIA. And Hubert Humphrey actually, according to his family, asked Dylan to run as vice president in 1968. But he really moves away from politics. He runs the kind of the family investment portfolio, but his main enthusiasm in the last part of his life is the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He goes on to be chairman of the Board of Trustees. He gives $20 million of his own money to the Met, and raises more than $100 million. And I think, again, that this is a good example of the kind of way in which he thought. That Douglas Dylan, as we said earlier, loved France and had been a collector of French Impressionist paintings throughout his life. But when he went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have one of the greatest collections of Impressionist paintings in the world. What they did not have at that time was very much in the way of Asian, particularly Chinese art. So even though Dylan has no personal interest in this, he fundraises relentlessly to get the money to solicit donations for a Chinese gallery at the Met. And again, that shows the sense of public duty, that it's not about him, it's about what the institution needs.
You're at Bard College. You're a professor, as I mentioned, of history there. What is teaching like these days? And I'm curious how your students shape your thought process and motivate you to keep writing these books. Number 11 now.
Yeah, I have to say that teaching at Bard really is a wonderful experience. And one of the principal reasons for that is the students. That, I mean, we teach in a very small environment, so you genuinely get to know your students. And one of the pleasures of teaching is that they always challenge you. They always, as well as me teaching them, they teach me. And even the way in which you realize that you have a particular way of thinking and it works very well for a couple of years, but then a new generation comes through and the thing that you'd been saying for a couple of years, they hold their hand up and they say, hang on a second, that doesn't work. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that these things, they feed into each other. I'm a better teacher because I write and research. So what they're getting is the most up-to-date research possible. But they, in turn, feed my ideas, my thinking, and challenge me too. So, yeah, it's a virtuous circle, I hope. Maybe I probably get more out of it than they get out of me.
Have you decided what or who is next?
I never do that. I'm very linear as a person. I write one book. I enjoy writing it, and then when it's done, I then think about what I'm going to do next. So, I mean, sometimes books come one from the other. That Dylan came out of an idea that I had when I was doing Schlesinger. At other times, I think I want to move away and do something completely different. So I'm still enjoying Dylan, but then I will think about what's going to come next.
Dr. Richard Aldous, the author of The Dylan Era, Douglas Dylan and the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson Administrations, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Evan. This has been such fun.
A lot of fun. I want to invite listeners to our Patreon page to ask for your support in keeping this show going. Go to patreon.com/axelbankhistory. We will donate part of your contributions to a charity for children's literacy. And thank you for listening to Axel Bank Reports, History and Today, conversations with America's top nonfiction authors and why their books matter right now. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Axel Bank History. We update those with clips from the show, guest announcements, and book recommendations. See you next time. Thanks.